It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here, and I'm back. Hello. Thanks to Robert Ballester for filling in for the last couple of weeks. I came back just in the nick of time. Turns out, Spectre's back, baby. Steve has the details next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 662, recorded Tuesday, May 8th, 2018. Spectre Next Gen. Security Now is brought to you by Thinkst Canary. Detect attackers or malicious insiders on your network with honeypots you can deploy in minutes. For 10% off and a 60-day money-back guarantee, go to canary.tools/twit and enter the code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box. And by Eno, your intelligent assistant from Capital One. Shop online without using your real credit card number for your favorite merchant sites. For more information, visit CapitalOne.com/Eno/virtual numbers. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover the latest in security and privacy with this guy right here, this cat, Mr. Stephen Gibson of the GRC Corporation. Hi, Stephen.
It's true. Leo, welcome back.
Nice,
you were missed.
I missed you guys, and thanks to Robert, Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit, for filling in.
And I heard you discussing on This Week in Google, which just preceded this podcast as a consequence of the change of schedule thanks to Google I.O., that you were mentioning Azure Sphere, which actually was the podcast topic week before last.
Indeed,
as you would expect, we covered it in great detail.
And do you concur that it is a good idea?
Absolute win for exactly the reasons that you reiterated on This Week in Google.
The idea that cheap Chinese manufacturers can actually make something secure.
Yes, and all they want to do is pump out the silicon and sell consumer products. They don't want the downstream responsibility that comes from the fact that they're actually shipping internet-connected computers.
I don't know all the details, but is Sphere cheap enough that somebody makes a cheap camera would still use it?
That is the question, whether the manufacturer decides that it is like – so inexpensive that it's better for like reputation damage.
Well, there'll be a little icon they could put on the box or something like that.
Yeah, and so the licensing of the chip, it's open license chip, it's open architecture, it's open source for Linux. The one thing that isn't is you do have to tie back to the Microsoft Azure cloud to get the the monitoring and maintenance. So we just don't know yet what the pricing is going to be. But fingers are crossed.
Good.
Speaking of fingers being crossed, today's – I can't believe this. Well, yes, I can. Spectre Next Gen.
What?
Yes.
More?
Yes. 8 new problems. Intel scrambling once again. One of them is way worse than Spectre ever was. So, I wish I were more surprised, but it really was the case that for decades we were blissfully, willingly not looking at the fact that an architecture that we were sharing was not secure in a shared environment. And as we've said, you know, anytime there is the residual effects of running code on a processor that then switches to a different environment, it's possible to very cleverly, I mean, these are not easy things to do, but you can figure out how the processor was changed by what it was just previously doing, and that leaks information. So anyway, that's the topic of the podcast. We'll get into it in more detail at the end of the show, but we've also got a bunch of other stuff. We've got first sort of like continuing on monitoring some stories that we've been covering, Russia versus Telegram. There's new activity there. Drupalgeddon 2, new activity there, including, you're going to love this, a Google spreadsheet of the 350-plus websites that have been now compromised. In fact, I made that the bit.ly shortcut link for the show. Anyone who's interested, bit.ly/SN-662, and that will take you to the rather distressing Google spreadsheet. We've got, believe it or not, the return, better than ever, of Rowhammer that affects Android smartphones. We have major new bad news, as I said, related to Spectre. Also, new crypto malware, Twitter's mistake with their passwords, which has gotten a lot of coverage. We have the new Android P security features. And I don't think we heard, did we, what P stands for?
No. They won't announce that to the fall.
Oh, okay.
Pumpkin pie. Anyway, but, I don't know.
But at least, yes, or pudding. Or
I think they should change it before then, because frankly, it's a little unseemly to keep talking about their P.
Okay. Yes. We also have a crazy service for GDPR compliance. This is the EU's privacy and security compliance, which we've touched on before. It comes into effect on May 25th, which is not far from now. And what catches everybody's attention is that, like, the apparent penalties for anyone whose services are global, meaning that an EU citizen might be your customer, are breathtaking in millions of dollars. Anyway, we'll talk about that and this crazy service that has an answer for it. Firefox has a plan for sponsored content. We got another million routers being attacked through a new means. Another instance of JavaScript being deliberately subverted, that is a JavaScript library. And I want to talk a little bit about what this really means in a bigger context, because it's very troublesome. Believe it or not, a new Microsoft Meltdown mistake, and the good news of a comprehensive 924, I think it is, page Windows command reference PDF that Microsoft has finally published. And a little indication that Twitter may be experimenting with encrypted DMs. So, secure messaging coming to Twitter. Yeah.
Interesting.
And based on the screenshot I saw, it looks like they did it right. It looks like elliptic curve keys are being sent back and forth. So, lots of news to talk about.
Well, I am excited to get back in the flow of security news with you. But first, I should just do a little bit of a word from our sponsor, if you don't mind. And if you're in security, it's actually a sponsor you not only know, but, if you don't know about them, you ought to know about them, called Canary. Oh, the Canary from Thinkst, Thinkst. I was reading a tweet from the CTO of Slack, I think it was, who said, number one security tool, Canary, from Thinkst. Now, above and beyond. What the Canary does, it's like the canary in the coal mine, is it lets you know when there's trouble afoot on your network. We'd actually talked about Canary some time ago, probably a few years ago now, because they have this thing called Canary tokens that they offer for free. Canary tokens are files. Well, they look like files you can put on your hard drive. Name them whatever you want. It could be a PDF that contains salary information or pictures of a scandalous nature, or just call them Donald Trump's tax returns, and put them on your drive there. And the Canary token will let you know when anybody accesses it. That's a great idea, isn't it? It's very clever. It's very simple. Well, the Canary itself is even better. It's a little bit of hardware you put on your network. I've got one right here we have on our network. We've had it for some time. I don't know if I can. Yeah, you can see it there. It's a tiny little thing. It's smaller than a router, for instance. But what it does is it sits on your network. This is the Canary interface, and this is actually what you want to see. No new alerts. The Canary sits on your network. You can make them look like anything you want. You can see in my case, it looks like a Synology NAS called Backup NAS. Its personality is Linux. You could configure it in a variety of ways. I've turned on port 21 for FTP, port 80 as a web server. I have it a port scan monitor on it. Windows file. I thought, what the heck? Let's turn on a Windows file share. Port 139 and 445 are open. That's like honey to a bee. I mean, that's, and the SSH is turned on. But this isn't really a Synology NAS. It just looks like a Synology NAS. Should anyone try to log in or hit it in any way, I will immediately get alerts. And those alerts are really useful. You don't get a whole bunch of alerts. You just get one high quality alert when it matters. This is the easiest, simplest way to create a honeypot on your system. The honeypot looks like something valuable. It's not. It's a canary. They don't look vulnerable. They look valuable. You could put fake files on them. You can even enroll them in Active Directory. And a bad guy just can't stay away. Well, that looks good, whatever that is. The company behind Canary has been in the security game for nearly two decades. They know their stuff. They've trained companies. They've trained militaries. They've trained governments on how to break into networks. And they've used the knowledge that they have to create something to prevent break-ins on your network. Had Sony Pictures had this on their network, they would have known that they had intruders. You want to know this. And it's very affordable. Now, the way it works is instead of some big massive upfront cost, you license them annually per year. You don't even need to own the canary. You just license them. If anything happens, if your bird breaks during the year, things just swaps it out, replaces it immediately. The pricing allows you to easily try a few, then scale them up as you need them. Some small shops have two canaries. Some larger banks have hundreds of canaries. I can't talk about who uses a canary, except, well, you know, I have one or two or three. I'm not going to say. The canaries are all over the world. They're literally on seven continents. That means including Antarctica. And some of the biggest names in Silicon Valley run them. You will love your canary. So here's what you do. Go to canary.tools/twit to get more information or to see them in action. Incidentally, every canary can be used to create canary tokens. So you have the hardware device on the network, but you can also put those canary token files everywhere on the network. And it's nice to have your own canary generating the tokens because they phone home to your local network instead of to Thinkst. So they really look like it's a real file. I mean, it really looks real. The cost, $7,500 a year for five canaries. And that includes your own hosted console. It includes all the upgrades, all the support, all the maintenance for a full year. But I'm going to make it an even better deal because we have a special offer for you. If you use the code TWIT, TWIT, in the How Did You Hear About Us box, not Security Now, just TWIT, you get 10% off the price, not just for the first year, but forever. That's a lot. We're sure you're going to love your Thinkst Canary, but if you're not happy, of course, you can always return to Canaries. They give you a two-month trial period, a two-month money-back guarantee for a full refund. So there's really no risk at all. Order it now. Just go right now to canary.tools/twit. Use the offer code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us section and just put them on your network. And the best thing you could ever, you know, get from your canary is nothing. Because I know there's no one on my network because I have sexy, sexy stuff on my network. These are honeypots. Man, are they honeypots. I mean, I can make them much more honey, much more attractive. But, you know, that Synology NAS. No, I could make this a Cisco router. I could make it a Windows file share. I can make one be, a SCADA device. You can set it up as a SCADA device, which, of course, people love to go after. Canary.tools/twit. Enter the code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us section to save 10% on your Thinkst Canary. It's a nice feeling to know you've got a canary.
Yes, Leo, you have a nuclear reactor in your backyard. And we're trying to shut down the cooling system of your SCADA connected.
Exactly, right? I think it was SCADA. Let me look here. This has
It is.
Yeah, all the device personalities are in here. You pick one. You can have all services turned on. The device name, you can make it, payroll, HTTP skin, so people can log in and they can see the login, the skin that they expect. It's completely configurable. I mean, it just really is sweet. Let me see. I'm pretty sure I saw you could have a Windows server, disk station, VMware, HP ILO server, a Joomla server, CUP service, JBoss. Yeah, SCADA. You can either do a Rockwell or a Siemens. You pick.
Take your pick. Siemens is more popular.
That's the one. That's the one the Iranians use. That's the one. That's the one I'd go for. Okay, back to you, Steve.
So our picture of the week, I got a kick out of. This was from the coverage of a disturbing new crypto malware. Unfortunately, even though cryptocurrency mining is the big thing, there's still people encrypting all the files on individuals' drives, trying to get ransom from them. And I got a huge kick out of the note, that, which I'll share when we get down to the story. But this is the Windows 10 login screen, which an unwitting user is greeted by after their system has fallen prey to this particular new SYNAC version of crypto malware, where it just sort of says, and in fact, the reason I got a kick out of this of what was written was that it sort of sounds like, oh, we didn't do this to you, but we'd like to help you get out of this pickle. And it's like, Anyway, so here on the login screen, your first experience of this is, hello, your files are encrypted. To restore files, please contact us by email, and then it's synac@scriptmail.com or synac@countermail.com. So it's like, oh, something encrypted your files.
Goodness. Hello, file encrypting person.
So anyway, we'll discuss this a little bit later. It uses a technique which we've already talked about, but essentially, these things that are effective never go away. And unfortunately, this is making some money for some people, and so it hasn't gone away. Speaking of what's not going away, we're going to doubtless be covering both in the U.S. here and everywhere else this tension, which is not going to go away, between a state's, a government entity's feeling of their right to and need to monitor communications within their boundaries, and the fundamental problem that cryptography robustly prevents that. So we've been over, and you didn't miss any of this, Leo, because it's been quiet. Well, maybe, no, I don't think you did. I think you, were you here when we talked about how the Russian government blocked about 20 million IPs? Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So that was the last news we had. So this is Russia versus Telegram. And, they first.
Well, this was part of it, wasn't it? That they had to block all those IP addresses to. Was it for Telegram? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So they first said, please give us the keys to all of the communications. And Telegram predictably said, no. Then they blocked Telegram's IPs. So Telegram moved over to Amazon and Google Cloud services specifically because that would be – it would like conflict with all these other services using the same things. And the Russian intelligence service said, we don't care. And so they just used like – it was like four massive /16s and 15s. So huge blocks of cloud space got blacklisted. And, of course, it did. It killed thousands of access to legitimate services. So that only lasted about a week and a half because there was so much back pressure, as you can imagine. I mean, this was a horrible thing to just block out about, I think it was like 19 million IP addresses. So then what happened is these IP restrictions got lifted, but Amazon and Google both started preventing what is technically an abuse of their service, which it's not clear whether they'd been allowing this deliberately or not, but they're not happy about it, and it's something that human rights organizations and people who wanted to prevent censorship have been using. So here's the idea. It's known as domain fronting, and it's been in the news a lot because Amazon did tell Moxie at Signal that they were going to have to stop using one of Amazon's domain names to sort of sneak their Signal communications through the Amazon cloud. The idea is that communications happens when you establish a connection to a remote site on several levels. There's the transport level where you look up the DNS, that you use DNS to look up the domain name's IP. Then you connect to that IP. Then you do the TLS handshake where, among other things, you use the SNI, the server name indication, to indicate which domain within a shared hosting environment you want to connect to. That allows the endpoint, the other endpoint that you're connecting to, the server, to provide to select among all the certificates it might have, and as part of the TLS handshake, to provide the proper one that matches the domain. Now you've established a encrypted connection. Then when you make a query, you also, in the query headers, have the host header, which specifies which domain you want to connect to. Well, get this. The way both Amazon and Google and Microsoft, the way all these big cloud providers have things set up, is it doesn't really matter for the first couple steps who you say you're connecting to. If you can say you're connecting to any service that particular provider offers at the DNS lookup and even at the TLS handshake level, and if you're really clever, once you've established that encrypted connection, which nobody doing deep packet inspection can see into, then you can use, or you have been able to, this is what just changed in the last week or two, you had been able to specify a different host name, an actual different, like, server you want to connect to, in the tunnel, in the TLS connected tunnel to the cloud, to get to anyone else. And so somebody monitored. So the point is, it turns out lots of people were doing this, who were using cloud hosting in order to sneak their traffic through passive packet and even deep packet inspection. So somebody monitoring packets would see an individual connecting to a non-censored, no reason to worry domain. But once that connection was established to an Amazon property or a Google property or a Microsoft Azure cloud property, then the actual query in the encrypted tunnel, which could no longer be observed, would be to a different domain. And so the idea is that these cloud providers were we're terminating the encryption at one layer, but then servicing the actual requests at a different layer. And they weren't connected, these layers. So they didn't know or care that the original handshake was to a domain different from the following queries being made in that tunnel. Now, this is technically an abuse of the service. I mean, this is not the way it's supposed to work. And cyber criminals have been abusing this too. So it hasn't just been, you know, people who we might want to be rooting for, you know, wanting them to have freedom within repressive regimes, or people trying to avoid censorship. Bad guys were actively doing this too. So what has happened is that this is being shut down. Microsoft and Amazon and Google have begun to shut this down. And in fact, in their letter to Moxie, Marlon Spike, of course, regarding Signal, Amazon wrote to Moxie saying, "Moxie, yesterday AWS became aware of your GitHub and Hacker News / Y Combinator posts describing how Signal plans to make its traffic look like traffic from another site, popularly, they write, known as domain fronting. By using a domain owned by Amazon, and that's souq.com, Amazon writes, you do not have permission from Amazon to use, I don't know how you pronounce that, souq? S-O-U-S-O-U-Q.com.
It's a, souq? I mean, I don't know, but it is Arab bazaar.
Okay.
They call them the souqs.
So they say, you do not have permission to use souq.com for any purpose. Any use of souq.com or any other domain to masquerade as another identity without express permission of the domain owner is in clear violation of the AWS service terms. And then they reference Amazon CloudFront Section 2.1, quote, you must own or have all necessary rights to use any domain name or SSL certificate that you use in conjunction with Amazon CloudFront, unquote. It is a violation of our acceptable use policy by falsifying the origin of traffic and the unauthorized use of a domain. We are happy for you to use, and there are meaning Signal, of course, for encrypted communications, to use AWS services, but you must comply with our service terms. We will immediately suspend your use of CloudFront if you use third-party domains without their permission to masquerade as that third party. So this has sort of been going on. It hasn't come up in our coverage because it's interesting, but it wasn't very controversial. Now, basically, this hack, which is, I mean, what it is, it's a hack to establish a connection under one domain and then issue queries to another domain. It's only a consequence of the architectural split in the way the cloud providers have been operating until now that has allowed this to be possible. So it's going away. And you know, unfortunately, my feeling is this is all abuse of technology. While I'm sympathetic to what people are doing, it's bound to fail. The, you know, Russia chasing after Telegram demonstrates that, you know, Telegram is going to lose this. And there's another one, it's not Ving, it's, I can't remember the name of it. There's another very popular encrypted application which the Russian intelligence organization has now notified they're next. So you know, it's been nice while it's lasted, but it's not going to last. There, you know, if a country like Russia decides that they absolutely refuse to allow encrypted communications that they cannot see into within their borders, they're going to win that battle. So anyway, what Russia has now done, unfortunately, in pursuing Telegram is to block 50 VPN and proxy services completely because they were being used by users to avoid the Russian filters. And so once again, it's like, okay, if this is what's going to happen. So VPN services, even when they were being used for benign reasons, they're all now suffering because some users are using them to still have access to encrypted communications with Telegram. So again, it's not something which is going to survive in the long term. If, you know, I'm sorry for the people within these repressive regimes, but the technology which sort of permits it to happen can't withstand someone who refuses to allow it to happen. The nation that you're in is going to win this. And of course, we're interested to see how this all comes down in the U.S. as well. But Telegram is already out of China. They're going to end up being out of Russia, and it will have just been, you know, a transient capability which ends up getting lost. There's just no way to avoid that kind of filtering. We've also been following for the last, about a month and a half, this drama with Drupal, a so-called Drupalgeddon 2, where a very critical vulnerability was discovered. All Drupal sites were given 1 week's notice of the availability of an update, and we could paint the future in this case, and it's unfolded exactly as expected. Leo, in the show notes here, I have a link to the Google Docs spreadsheet, which has a list of more than 350 known Drupal sites that have been compromised and are currently serving a cryptocurrency miner into the browsers of everyone who visits them. Most notable among them is Lenovo. Every visitor to Lenovo is running, unless their own browser blocks it, a malicious cryptocurrency miner
to the main
in their
Lenovo
browsers.
Site?
Yes.
That's crazy.
Yes. I noticed, I don't know why, a lot of religious sites were there. The National Labor Relations Board in the U.S. was breached and had this. It's jquery.once.js ?v=1.2 is the cryptocurrency miner which has been edited into those Drupal sites,
wow,
which is then downloaded by visitors' browsers and run.
So on this spreadsheet, some stuff is pink and or red, and some stuff is yellow. Is the yellow less?
I don't know why. I saw that too, and I didn't see any key or indication of what that meant.
Wow.
But it's quite sobering to see the actual list of sites there. And cybersecurity firm Imperva also discovered another campaign, also against Drupal sites, which they named Kitty because the JavaScript which is being maliciously installed is ME0W, so, you know, meow.js. Thus, it's the Kitty malware campaign. That one is running a Monero miner from webminerpool.com. And in addition, they're installing a persistent PHP backdoor into any site that they compromise, giving them long-term access after the site's owner updates. Of course, that follows on to the long-standing wisdom, which is after your site has been compromised, there you can't trust anything about it. I mean, you really have to wipe and reinstall from scratch, because if bad guys get in, they can install all kinds of persistent mischief that you have no way of detecting in some cases. And they're also running a server-side miner. So, you know, this goes from, in our coverage, from here comes a problem. It's, you know, everybody patch as soon as you can. Inevitably, that will not be heard because Drupal is the second most popular content management system on the net. It will, you know, WordPress being first. Many sites will not patch. They will immediately, within a day, it was the patch was on a Wednesday. The next day, on the following Thursday, there was already sniffing traffic being picked up of sort of a precursor that matured into attacks. Then we covered, yes, attacks are happening, and now we have lists of compromised sites. So unfortunately, no surprises here. This is going exactly the way we now know these things go, unfortunately. So hopefully people will see the list of sites that are compromised, know somebody at, you know, individuals, know somebody there and say, hey, do you realize your site's been compromised? You've got bad guys running around in your system, because this is a remote execution attack. So very, very serious and critical attack. Okay. It's being called Glitch, G-L-I-T-C-H. And GL is in caps in the name of this, as in WebGL. A group of researchers at the university in Amsterdam have developed a new startlingly effective remote attack against Android smartphones using the user's web browser and the device's built-in GPU via JavaScript and the WebGL API. So what this means is they have demonstrated that a user of Android visits a particular website. JavaScript is delivered and runs either under Chrome or Firefox. They tested it under both. And get this, in 2 minutes, the attack is so potent that and I should mention, this is Rowhammer. Within 2 minutes, their phone is compromised. So it's the first Rowhammer attack to leverage GPUs to leak the computer's memory contents and allow bad guys remotely to compromise a phone. We've been talking about Rowhammer for quite a while. Remember that it leverages a essentially noise in RAM access to cause a bit to flip in the actual memory grid of dynamic RAM as a consequence of it's sort of being a malicious access pattern. And it turns out that GPUs are far more effective than CPUs. The reason we haven't seen this on desktops before is that GPUs have their own memory. On lower-end devices like smartphones and tablets, the GPU shares main memory with the CPU. So by leveraging WebGL, which gives the JavaScript extremely accurate timing information, they're able to perform a cache attack with GPU, because the GPU has a much shallower cache than the CPU does, in order to compromise the device within about 2 minutes. So what's not clear is whether there has been some fuzzing in the WebGL support on those browsers. There had been some fuzzing in timing in response to Meltdown and Spectre earlier this year. Under the cert.org page, I went looking to see specifically whether Mozilla and Google with Chrome had responded, and nothing was there. Although in digging around, I saw some reference to perhaps this already having been taken advantage of, but nothing yet posted publicly. So it's not clear. Certainly both companies know, and I'm sure they will be arranging to limit the timing accuracy of WebGL. And essentially that's the crucial thing, as we have been seeing a lot lately, to determine whether for Rowhammer to be used to penetrate caching, is you have to be able to sense whether a particular access was cached or not, and for that you need to know with very good accuracy what the timing was. So anyway, we do have, again, another instance of our famously often quoted, and I think it was Bruce Schneier who said, attacks never get worse, they only get better. And so here's Rowhammer, which continues to cause us trouble. And hopefully downstream, we will see some improvements at the hardware level. What we know is that it's possible to more intelligently refresh DRAM, either increase the refresh rate, which lowers the bandwidth that we can use the RAM, so it essentially slows the DRAM down but hardens it against attack, or probably in the future we're going to see Rowhammer-resistant hardware design, which notices that there is an access pattern, which may not be malicious, because there's nothing inherently malicious about accessing DRAM. It turns out you can leverage it. So next generation DRAM hardware will probably preferentially refresh rows adjacent to those being accessed heavily in order to prevent these bits from flipping, and thus essentially over time adapt the hardware to the attacks. Now, of course, downstream, that's where we have to end up being with this continual flow of Spectre problems with the hardware that we'll be talking about a little bit more in a second. I wanted to soften the blow to our listeners who are using Firefox as their preferred browser, as I am, with the news, first of all, that Firefox 60 will be returning to a sponsored content model on for newly opened tabs. They purchased Pocket last year, and Pocket will be providing some sponsored content. So for people who want to support Mozilla, I think this is a good thing. It's, first of all, it is important to know that Mozilla is absolutely protecting the privacy of their users who view this sponsored content. There's no age, gender, location, user data being sent back to the advertisers who are on these promoted stories, which will be appearing on Firefox's newly opened tabs by default. And if you really object to this, you can turn them off. So first is, maybe you want to support Firefox, as I certainly do. So know that Firefox is keeping the interaction privacy enforced. But if you do object to it, rather than abandoning Firefox, you can just under the little gear icon on a newly opened tab, you can simply turn off. It's just a checkbox, show sponsored stories, and that can be turned off. So, I hope that Firefox and Mozilla stay with us, because it's good to have a solid second to Chrome, if only that. And I still prefer it. Until Chrome gives us much more manageable memory footprint and tabs on the side, I mean, integrated side tabs, which there's been some talk of, but we haven't seen it yet. Firefox is the only browser I can use, because it just makes it possible to use, to have lots of tabs open. So the news, Bleeping Computer, had some good coverage about somebody trying to hide a backdoor in a popular JavaScript NPM package. And the specific story itself is interesting, but the background and the trend we're seeing is, I think, deeply worrying, which is that there are an increasing number of instances of JavaScript packages being deliberately compromised, not mistakes being made that are found, but backdoors being installed in packages, being snuck into packages on an ongoing basis. In Bleeping Computer's coverage, they talked about extensively previous instances where this had been done. And if anyone wants the full story, I have the Bleeping Computer link in the show notes. But my bigger concern is that the entire, and I have to put this in air quotes, security model, because, I mean, it's an insecurity model, which has just sort of quietly and innocently evolved, is deeply flawed. As we know, the way it is today, websites you visit have links in their page headers which cause our browsers to go out and indiscriminately download JavaScript packages, which their site developers, or sometimes their site's packages developers, I mean, it's like multiple levels of it's not my problem indirection, cause these things, these executable code to be downloaded and run in our browsers. And in the case that Bleeping Computer talked about, it was a cookies packages that was like three levels removed, where a deliberate exploit had been inserted into it, which just happened to be found by people who noticed that you could put a certain you could use a certain format of query in a header to essentially cause the site cause the browser to execute a command that it wasn't authorized to, by embedding this in a header. So, I mean, somebody deliberately embedded a backdoor into this JavaScript that was in this JavaScript package being downloaded. So the problem is, I have no solution for this problem. I am profoundly unhappy with the way the world has evolved in this regard. This lack of responsibility, and this tendency to just keep adding JavaScript packages from third-party sites that, for functions that the website uses in order to, and I mean, we've looked at this. Sometimes it's like 40 different sites are having JavaScript pulled from into the user's browser. And of course, we know that web security requires every single one of them to behave themselves and not to misbehave. Any one of them that does compromises our security. So the good news is the browser vendors understand this, and they're doing everything they can to create a sandboxed environment. I don't blame anybody for running their own sandbox or running a browser in a VM, you know, like adding belts and suspenders to the existing security model of the browser. But it's bad enough, I guess is my point, where mistakes happen like as mistakes. It's really becomes worrisome when there's a strong incentive for packages to be deliberately backdoored and then leveraged against people who unwittingly download them. So anyway, I just in looking at this coverage in Bleeping Computer, I just thought, wow, you know, I guarantee you we will be talking in the future about this kind of problem. This is different than what got Drupal, but, you know, very worrisome. And on that happy note, Leo, I think we should do our second break.
If it's worrisome, I want to talk about it. All right. Let's talk about Capital One. Now, talk about worrisome. Every time you use a credit card online, you probably maybe are a little bit nervous. If you've ever been bit by a credit card fraud, I had. It's happened to me many times. The one that I comes to mind is there's a South American, I don't want to get too specific, but there's a South American case maker. They make beautiful leather cases. I love them. And I don't think they're crooked, but, you know, somehow I used a credit card and it's South America. And within minutes, my credit card was compromised. Somebody used it, you know. Of course, in most cases with credit cards, you can call the credit card company. It's just a pain, right? Say it was misused and they'll, you know, you don't lose any money, but then you have to get a new credit card, a new number. And then the worst thing in the world happens, which is the part I hate, which is that you then have to go out and change the credit card number on all these other sites. Because one of the things I do, and I don't know if you do this, but I bet you a lot of you do this, is I will use a recurring charge on things like magazines, websites, newspapers. And those charges are going to fail at some point. I also use credit cards often to pay bills. That's even a little more serious. I mean, it's one thing if, you know, my New York Times subscription says you couldn't use your credit card. Give us a new one. It's another thing if the power's turned off because the electric company can't charge you on your credit card. And I've had things like that happen. It's very embarrassing. So that's why I am really excited to talk about Capital One and their new Eno and their virtual numbers. Stop sharing your real credit card number when you shop online. Start using these virtual numbers. We've talked about this idea before, but Eno has done it right. First of all, it's a Chrome extension. So anytime I'm on a website and I want to install pay a credit card bill or set up a credit card bill, I could just, you know, form fill it with LastPass. But now what I do is Eno pops up from Capital One and it says, you want to use this? It creates a unique number, merchant-specific number, gives you a new expiration date 5 years from the current date and a new security number. And then it fills it right in. Now, here's the beauty part. It is tied to your main Capital One credit card, but that number is unique to that merchant. And two great things happen. First of all, if that merchant is compromised, boom, no problem. You get your money back. You disable that number, and that number is fine, and nothing else happens. The other thing that's great is, let's say you lose your credit card, the physical credit card. Well, that does not disconnect those specialized one-time use virtual numbers. They're still good. So you don't have – they call it – actually, we talked to – it's fun. Tom Poole, he is a senior VP of digital e-commerce at Capital One. He's a guy who kind of came up with this virtual numbers idea, and he calls it the reset moment. You can listen right here. Let's see. Let me press the button.
When we looked at this and realized that the most pressing problems our customers were facing was this giant reset moment, this whether the card expires or it's lost or stolen or it's compromised online, this moment when suddenly out of the blue you were being asked to spend a couple hours updating your numbers on every single site, it's terrible. And people live in fear of it.
Yes.
So much so that they actually steer their shopping toward a handful of sites that they trust and avoid trialing new experiences and new products precisely because they're afraid that it's a game of Russian roulette. If they put their number at one more site, that might be the site that triggers the event that is the real pain in the neck for everybody.
See, but I like e-commerce. I like buying stuff online. I don't ever worry about the reset moment because now whenever I pay for anything online, I use my Capital One virtual numbers. It gives me security in both directions. If the merchant's shady, I don't have to worry about that. If I lose my credit card, I don't have to worry about – and I've literally done this, get my credit card statements and go through everybody else who's got that credit card number for a recurring payment and change it. It's so much simpler. No reset moment. If you are already a Capital One subscriber, just download and install the Eno browser extension from the Chrome Web Store. Yeah, Eno from Capital One. So it's just E-N-O, which is one backwards. Took me a while to figure that out. Shop safer without all the hassle. Eno's got your back with virtual numbers from Capital One. You can also find out more if you're not a Capital One credit card holder. You might want to check it out, too. CapitalOne.com/Eno/virtual numbers. This is just, you know, clearly the right way to do it. And I really like it. And, they've implemented this beautifully, especially because of that Chrome extension. They tell me, by the way, they're working on the Firefox for you, Steve, the Firefox extension, and other browsers as well. But right now you can get the Chrome extension at the Chrome Web Store or go to CapitalOne.com/Eno/virtual numbers. We thank Capital One for not only supporting this show, but doing the right thing with virtual numbers.
Yay.
Back to you. Yay.
So, okay, this is just, it's not really comic relief because it's...
I'm laughing.
It's because it's if you're affected by this, it's just
it's not
like
funny. Yeah.
Terminal.
Yeah.
But this is the guys that did this crypto malware, which encrypts all of a victim's system. What you get is a read this, please, and then a unique string of 8 characters .txt file. And I'm going to read this exactly as is because it's clear that English is not their first language. But it says, as if it's like a
not our fault.
Of some
We're
sort.
So sorry. Yeah.
They have a nice acronym too, FES. So it's SYNAC, FES, Centered Files Encryption Software. Dear client, right? Client, we apologize for inconvenience with your files. Oh, yes. It's a little inconvenient that they're all encrypted and we can't get them. So we make a business offer to order file recovery service from us. We do not extort money. Files restore is an optional service.
Absolutely.
And otherwise, you just give up right now and go home.
It's optional.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Eat or die. Also, we will do auditing of your network for free, all caps. They've already been in, right, rummaging around, destroying everything. Oh, look, we found a bug for free if you order file recovery service. So, some details about SYNAC FES. This software uses, and then it's actually true, an ECIES-SECP192R1 algorithm.
Oh, I thought that was made up. That's real?
It's actually real. To create unique pair of private and public keys for the session, which basically means you're screwed. The encryption is good and you can't get it back. Each file is encrypted with random key using AES-ECB-256 algorithm. And, if I were nasty, that's what I would do. We strongly recommend you do not to use third-party decryptors because they can damage your files. Right. we encrypted them, but don't try to decrypt them. But if you want to try to restore your files by yourself, make sure you have made backup copies of encrypted files. So they're being really helpful here, Leo, because, you might try to fix it yourself, but just make backup copies.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that we can help you after you give up. And please do not remove files with text notes because they contain important information required for file restoring. If you want to order file recovery service, which of course is not extortion, it's entirely optional, up to you if you ever want your files back, please contact their, I'm sorry, back to them, please contact our support using one of the following email addresses. And then those are the two addresses I gave at the top of the show, synac@scriptmail.com and synac@countermail.com. If you have not get a response in 24 hours, please do not panic, because, you know, because they're very busy decrypting everyone's files and offering this great service. Please do not panic and write on BitMessage, and then using site https://bitmessage.me, and then they give you their crypto key handle. Keep in mind that there are fake services offering decryption. Leo, how could anyone set up a fake service to offer decryption? Do not believe them, or you will lose your money. Anyway, there is one
method. We wouldn't
want
you to lose your money.
No,
we want you to send
no.
it to us.
Exactly. So we can properly decrypt the files that we
That's
have
right. It's not a
encrypted.
Loss. No, no.
That's right. It's a recovery. Anyway, there is one method you can use for proof.
Oh.
Ask to decrypt some files for free.
Oh, nice of them.
No one except
free
us
trial.
Will be able to do that. And then we have, please include the following text in your message. And then they've got a 6-line gibberish key thing. Best regards, Synac team.
I didn't know about this bit message thing. That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
So bitmsg.me, and then you, of course, have to have a key.
Yep.
I presume it's a crypto. It's like a cryptocurrency key. Is it actually using?
Not cryptocurrency,
it's
but
like
it is a cryptographically. Yeah, it's a cryptographically strong key.
That's funny.
Which you're then able to use to send them a message.
Nice.
And they're able to reply.
Good.
So, for what it's worth, crypto malware is still with us, and
I think it's worse than ever, Steve. I think the numbers are actually up, aren't they?
Yeah, it is, unfortunately. Yeah. And you know, people click links, and
yes,
that's what
do.
Happens when you
they
click
do,
the link.
Do.
It's like, yeah, I'm a African prince, and I have all this money for you.
Mm-hmm.
I just need to talk to you a little bit.
You
click
got that
this
email
link.
Too? Oh.
Well, you and I are both, friends of his, Leo.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So, okay, Twitter discovers a mistake. 330 million people are asked to change their passwords.
That's everyone,
email.
By the way. That's everyone.
That's everyone. Yes, everyone. The email from them said, hi@sggrc. When you set a password for your Twitter account, we use technology that masks it so no one at the company can see it, meaning no one at Twitter, and not to mention anybody else who obtains their database. We recently identified a bug that stored passwords unmasked in an internal log. We have fixed the bug, and our investigation shows no indication of breach or misuse by anyone. Out of an abundance of caution, we ask that you consider changing your password on all services where you've used this password, meaning Twitter and everywhere else where you also used it. You can change your Twitter password anytime by going to the password settings page. And then they just explain about the nature of this. So I guess my feeling is everyone should decide if – hopefully you don't use that password anywhere else. So this is the common advice now of not using this same password anywhere else, annoying as that is. If you're worried about somebody actually having obtained it and tweeting, impersonating you on Twitter, being able to log in as you, and which could cause you to lose access to your Twitter account, then you may feel the need to change it. It's, it's not hard to do. And then update your password manager in order to know what your new Twitter password is. You know, I think they've done the right thing. GitHub also, just like a week ago, had the same problem. They're completely unrelated. Essentially, there are, you know, part of their developers, their developer pipeline was they were making some changes or doing some maintenance. They turned on a log at a point where incoming passwords were logged in the clear before being robustly encrypted with bcrypt, which is what both services, Twitter and GitHub, are using, which is a good state-of-the-art password-based key derivation system. And so I think, you know, you should consider changing your Twitter password. I imagine everybody got that email. You probably are aware of that. It doesn't mean that it was breached. They believe it wasn't. But again, as they said, out of an abundance of caution, we're recommending that people change their password. So,
yeah, it's I mean, if you have two-factor, you're probably not at huge risk. Although the real problem is a lot of people use the same password on multiple sites. So that's the one to watch out for.
Yes.
If you reuse that password, you have other places to change it.
Yep. Okay, so we don't know yet what the P of Android P stands for. What O was Oreo, right? As we march through the alphabet. Yep. So whatever it is, we know a few things about it. They've talked about some of the security and privacy features which are coming. A nice one is that there was some worrisome cross-app leakage of network use. Any app which declared that it needed network access, well, and really what app these days doesn't, would, by getting that blanket permission, have access to the /proc/net process, which this has long been known, and it's I don't quite get why it took so long for Google to restrict this, and they are now. But it wasn't a data leakage. There's no way that would have been allowed. But any app could see what any other app was doing from a standpoint of what things they were accessing. So there was a clear privacy concern that all apps that had any access to networking features essentially were able to watch the global Android OS procnet process and see what other apps were doing. That's being restricted only to VPNs or apps which Google closely looks at to understand why they have a need to access that. So it is being removed from the way it has always been in P. Also, the good news is Android P will block clear text, that is HTTP traffic, from all apps. HTTPS will now be the only means of accessing the net. So, yay, we're finally at that point where that kind of enforcement is practical, which it hasn't been until now. You know, there have been some instances where you had to have non-encrypted traffic. No more. So anybody who has an endpoint with an app in Android needs to be able to encrypt it so that their app will be able to get to their endpoint. Also, P will use a uniform UI when requesting fingerprint authentication across apps and devices. So there's been a concern that your fingerprint authentication could be spoofed. And so now they're going to lock that down, and there'll just be one UI that all apps share in order to get this. Also, we were talking recently about apps accessing the phone's camera and microphone without any notification. That'll be blocked from all background apps by default. Also, P will encrypt backups on the device with a local secret key before setting the backup for storage on Google's services. So, yay to that. And two last things. It will Android P will begin experimenting with support for MAC address randomization. And this is an important feature. Recall, we've talked about this before with regard to iOS. If you're all Wi-Fi is Ethernet, and Ethernet uses a 48-bit MAC. The Media Access Control ID. By design, that's a unique number so that you never have two devices that might be on the same Ethernet with the same MAC, or they will collide because the traffic is routed to the devices by their MAC address. So if you were, in the case, for example, of iOS, which has resolved this, if you were just wandering around with your Wi-Fi radio on, the MAC address of your device would, if steps were not taken, be available to without associating to an access point just because you're out looking, you know, enumerating the Wi-Fi in your neighborhood. As we've discussed before, Apple has long ago solved this by using a randomized MAC address, which is not actually you, until you associate with the access point. So once you're actually associated with the access point, then your real MAC address is used. But otherwise, it's just random. So that's a really nice trade-off for staying compatible with the standards, yet not actually being a unique MAC that can wander around. So it's good news that Android P is going to begin rolling this feature. I don't know what it actually means. All I could find was, quote, begin experimental support of. So maybe, you know, they're just being cautious about this. Well, we'll have to see. And lastly, support for DNS over TLS, which is another great thing. Remember that DNS by default is over UDP, which is unencrypted. DNS over TLS means probably that Android will be using Google's DNS and set up an encrypted tunnel over which all DNS queries will flow to hugely boost privacy. So that's all for the best. And I talked at the top of the show about this upcoming GDPR compliance issue. I will be updating GRC and explicitly stating in our privacy policy, explicitly stating why and how we are GDPR compliant. It's easy for us, and as a small organization, and you are too, Leo, you're less than 250 people, so the requirements are substantially reduced. But both of us, GRC and TWIT, have services available to citizens in the EU. So the point is, you know, you are, if any site that is offering services globally, and where global includes the EU as it does, needs to be GDPR compliant. And enforcement begins on the 25th of this month, 25th of May. Anyway, I got the biggest kick out of this. This is truly a service, GDPR-shield.io. GDPR-shield.io. And the banner comes up with the big news, the good news. You can save thousands on GDPR compliance. And then the little subheading here, simply paste our JavaScript snippet into your... Huh?
Okay. Sure. No problem.
Simply paste our JavaScript snippet into your website's code. We'll check every visitor of your site and we'll block access to users located within the EU. Yay! Problem solved.
Well, that is one way to do it. That's what Unroll.me does. They don't let anybody from Europe. But, I think based on what you were talking about earlier, probably wouldn't be a good idea if people just paste JavaScript snippets into their websites in general.
Exactly. That's
who
probably
knows what
exactly.
it really does. And by the way, I think it's down because I just went to GDPR-shield.io and it's not responding. So.
Oh, no kidding. Interesting.
What a surprise.
Okay. Well, who knows what's going on there. I do have a picture of the site as it from Bleeping Computers coverage where they grabbed a screenshot of the homepage, so showing it. And okay, so the ultimate goal of GDPR, and we've not covered it extensively here, is we just mentioned it in passing that it was coming, but it was a long way off, and now it's here, is to give individuals more rights over their data and to restrict how companies process private information. What was really, as I mentioned before, caught everyone's attention is the impossible to sanely ignore fines which the legislation imposes upon anyone whose site could be or services are accessible by citizens in the EU. Under just GDPR regulation, firms can be fined, hope everyone is sitting down for this, up to 20 million euros, about 28 million US dollars, or 4% of the company's worldwide turnover, and I guess that's profits, whichever is greater, not the lesser of, the greater of 28 million US dollars, about 20 million or 20 million euros, or 4% of your revenue, whichever is greater. You have to have, for example, a data protection officer, a DPO, which having one is mandatory. But then it turns out, whoops, slow down, wait a minute. If you have fewer than 250 employees, things are a little better for us, me, Leo, by a lot, and you also, fortunately. We do not need to have, small firms do not need to have explicit documentation explaining why personal data is being collected and processed, which information is being stored or for how long, although I fully intend to explain. Essentially, the only stuff we have is what we collect for the purpose of selling SpinRite. And
well, wait a minute, you have server logs.
No, I don't.
You don't have any server logs?
None.
So when somebody visits your site, your servers do not log their IP addresses?
Nope, no record.
That's general practice for most websites. You're
not
smart. Now you don't have to worry about it. Do you actively delete them, or is there a setting you can turn it off?
I don't log. No, I have no need to log. No reason to.
Okay.
I'll explain. I'm going to update our privacy policy. As I mentioned, if someone said, "I want you to delete your record of me of my purchase," fine. You won't be able to upgrade because we use your purchase record in order to, previous proof of purchase. But fine. And that's essentially all that's necessary for compliance is for a small firm is. To be conscious of users' rights, to tell users what information you are storing about them clearly, and to give them the right to be forgotten, to give them the right to request deletion. So we had that capability, and I'm happy to make that available. So. Anyway, so for what it's worth, I wanted to sort of plant the bug in our listeners' ears. I know we have a lot of listeners in enterprises of all sizes. And so just be aware that this May 25th deadline is approaching. Oh, and for what it's worth, it's not as if a single infraction immediately causes the levying of a 20 million euro fine. That's a ceiling. And historically, these privacy fines have been, I mean, it's like only if after warnings and you've been told and blah, 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 you don't fix things. So it's there, but it doesn't mean suddenly you're going to get a bill from the European Union for 20 million euros. It doesn't work that way. But, you know, I'm glad that the EU is putting this stuff in place because this is what all sites should do. All sites, so websites and services should say, you know, here's the data we're collecting on you. And if you object to this, we'll delete it for you. So and I guess if that deletion capability is absent, that's something that you would need to look at, I mean, immediately, because this GDPR regulation requires that people doing business in the EU have the ability to delete EU citizens' data completely from their services and sites and so forth. So that's not there. You need to have that.
I don't know how we're going to do that. Jeez. Well, I'm sure we have server logs, but that I could turn off. But we log every download because that's how you count the downloads, and we log the IP address. Is logging an IP address considered to be a violation of privacy?
Good question. I don't know.
I mean, you keep track of an IP address for at least as long as the conversation is going on with your website. You wouldn't be able to have a conversation otherwise.
True.
But
true.
But that's a transient log. That's going to be interesting.
Be interesting to see whether IP address quotes. Now, I mean, you certainly, it only means something when you de-anonymize the IP.
Which you can easily do, but you can't get down, can't get to an individual, usually only to their internet service provider. I have to find that out.
Yeah, it's worth, that's a really good question, whether an IP, I'm sure now that we've discussed this on the podcast, my Twitter feed will be full of information.
Yeah, and that's all we know because we don't ask for additional information.
Right.
And we don't even sell anything. We have, you know, there's nothing, but we do, I mean, we use Google Analytics, which logs IP address and probably does geographic locationing. And we certainly do that for downloads. Whenever you download a show, that's how we know how many people listen to the show. That's how we charge.
Yeah.
So I don't know. We are well under 250 employees, but I don't think that lets us off the hook entirely.
No, it does not.
Yeah.
No.
Oh, I didn't even thought about that. Ay, ay, ay.
Well, yeah, I don't. It seems to me. I mean, in the case of the IP address, if someone said, "This is my IP, remove it from your logs." I mean, if you haven't de-anonymized them, if you don't have a name associated with the IP, and neither of us do, I don't even have logs because I just don't need them and I don't want them for privacy. I mean, I have no need for them. Then. The only thing I could imagine is someone says, this is my IP, you know, expunge it from your logs, which technically is possible.
Standard server logs with IP addresses must be disclosed in a privacy policy, but you don't have to get consent because they're being collected as part of a business critical to prevent need to prevent fraud.
Nice. Good.
Yeah. So you can collect them, but you do have to disclose that you collect them. I think we do that already in our privacy policy. I don't know how we would delete them, though. You must routinely delete logs, you know, in 60 to 90 days, I think. Oh, I have to look at this.
Yeah. Well, and in fact, in your case, keeping an IP longer than that doesn't serve any purpose.
No, we don't need them, yeah.
They float around.
We probably do delete them. You know, typically delete logs, you know, because you don't want to have infinite. Our logs are very large.
They do get big.
They are very big.
Yeah. In GRC's privacy policy, I explain that we don't log by default, but if we need to track down a problem, we may turn logging on briefly while resolving the problem.
That's typically why somebody logs, right?
You know, so you turn it off and shut down. Yeah. Okay, so more than 1 million DASAN GPON routers are under attack. So DASAN is a South Korean manufacturer that produces routers known as GPON. That's gigabit passive optical network routers. There are big networks in Vietnam, Kazakhstan, and Mexico. And more than 1 million of these routers have been identified from scans of the net. The 360 NetLab researchers have identified a botnet controlled from Vietnam currently scanning and exploiting these devices. What's worrisome, there are two CVEs that have been created for these, 10561 and 10562. 561 reads, an issue was discovered on DASAN GPON home routers. It is possible to bypass authentication, get this, Leo, by simply appending question mark images to any URL of the device that requires authentication, like, you know, the login, as demonstrated by /menu.html?images/or, and then they give some more options. Anyway, one can then manage the device. And these devices have remote management exposed to the internet, of course, by default, password protected, but it doesn't matter because you just put question mark images on and that bypasses, essentially just skips over the check. Then, as if that wasn't bad enough, the next sequentially numbered CVE, 10562, an issue was discovered on DASAN GPON home routers. Command injection can occur via the dest host parameter in the diag action equals ping request, and it goes on. Essentially, there is a remote command injection vulnerability that makes it quite simple to execute commands and retrieve their output on the router. So we can bypass authentication and give them commands. As a result, they are being swept up right now in a botnet being controlled from Vietnam. So another instance of home routers with a vulnerability that is discovered and then immediately exploited by bad guys. And it's good news to the individuals whose routers are exploited that people just want to use their bandwidth, probably mine crypto or use them to spread a worm. Who knows? But yeah, the world we live in today. Speaking of the world we live in today, Alex Iannisou, who is with he's a security researcher we've referred to often with CrowdStrike, tweeted on May 2nd, so what, last Wednesday, he said, "Welp, WELP, it turns out the Meltdown patches for Windows 10 had a fatal flaw. Calling NT call enclave returned back to user space with the full kernel page table directory, completely undermining the mitigation." He writes, "This is now patched on RS4, so that's, I'm sure, Redstone 4, but not earlier builds." And he asks, "No backport?" Okay, now what was funny was that as I'm reading this tweet, I'm thinking, wait a minute, that sounds eerily familiar. Yes, at the end of March, on the 28th of March, we discussed on this podcast the so-called total meltdown bug, which exposed the system's memory, the virtual memory manager page tables for Windows 7 and Server 2008 R2 systems. And remember, we talked about it at the time. Basically, it was supposed to have the system privilege bit set, but it returned with the user privilege set, which allowed user access to the entire global memory map and read-write access to all of the system's memory. Whoops! So that was the total meltdown. That was an emergency patch by Microsoft. Now, what was found was that the meltdown patches for Windows 10, not including the most recent Redstone 4, which is the just released last week, version 1803 version of Windows 10, all previous ones apparently have, as Alex tweets, this very bad mistake made in the meltdown mitigation. So I also, just as we were going to the start recording the podcast, I saw a note from Brian Krebs talking about this is the second Tuesday of May. The podcast last May was May 1st, May Day, the first Tuesday of the month. So this is Patch Tuesday, but I've been checking for patches all morning and getting nothing. Brian just tweeted, as I just saw him send actually email out to his email list, that there are a bunch of patches, 67 of them, I think I saw him say. So I've not had a chance to look at them. Hopefully, this fix for this is among them for Windows 10 users who have not moved up to 1803. And as we talked about last week, there have been a lot of problems with this Redstone update. Among them, apparently, the Spectre mitigations are not present, and there's no go out and do them yourself patch yet for those. Although I have one report of the Spectre mitigations being built in to 1803, which is what we would expect. So still unknown in detail about that. Leo, Microsoft has published a 948-page PDF.
I was just reading that.
The long-awaited Windows Console Command reference. Never before in one place.
Has it been documented?
No.
There's no help file?
It's just sort of all scattered and around, and you kind of have to know who to ask. Now, here it is. I got the link in the show notes. For anyone who's interested, I also tweeted it. So at SGGRC, if you're following me on Twitter, you've got a link. It's the 250 Windows console commands on a just shy of 1,000 page PDF. So all kinds of stuff.
Wow.
Yeah, really cool.
Wow. You know, they're actually, I think, deprecating it. With, you know, they want you to use PowerShell, not to.
Right.
Not the command console. Holy
right.
cow.
And just finally, I will note that Twitter has an unlaunched secret encrypted messages feature. A security researcher rummaging around in the pre-release land of the Twitter Messenger app saw a reference to the ability to provide your keys and exchange keys and apparently do encrypted DMs. Shortly after the Snowden revelations, Edward tweeted to Twitter, to whoever the head honcho is or was at the time, that it would be nice to have encrypted Twitter messages. And the response from Twitter was, that's interesting. We'll look into it. And it appears that we may, before long, be talking about encrypted DMs, where you would arrange somehow to exchange, based on the length of the keys, they have to be elliptic curve keys, so they're manageable length. You would somehow exchange those with someone and then be able to use Twitter to send encrypted DMs to each other, which by the nature of the way good encryption, properly done encryption works, nobody would be able to access your tweets, would be a nice feature. Speaking of a nice feature, I got a fun, nice piece of email from a Bree Duffy, who's located in Oregon. This was the 26th of April he sent this with a subject. He said, a security concern. And then he said, and comma, SpinRite saves my sister's hard drive and me a headache. And he said, when I heard about the virtual card numbers from Capital One, what Leo, you were just talking about on your show.
Oh, cool.
I was highly intrigued, and I would argue, as he should be. He said, however, I'm also highly distrustful of apps from most companies due to concerns of snooping or downright sloppy programming causing issues. Do you have any thoughts on the safety of Capital One's Eno plugin for desktop or the phone app? And of course, I have no, just to respond to that, I have no like a priori explicit knowledge, but I would argue, I mean, you know, we've talked about per use credit card numbers, and I think that is a huge benefit. So I'm bullish on the service, and, you know, I imagine that
I'm sure it's well coded.
This was done well coded. Yeah.
I mean, you know, first of all, we should say they're a sponsor, as you know, because you just heard their ad.
Right.
But, you know, how many different programs and services you're running on a typical PC?
Exactly.
You know, I agree. And it is kind of my motto. Don't install anything you don't need.
But if it's useful.
But if it's useful, install it. Yeah. Like in a Chrome plugin is probably
That's exactly not, what I was going to say, yeah. I was talking about, you know, how well sandboxed our browsers are now as a consequence of the risk of third-party JavaScript being downloaded. You know, these are one of the good guys, not one of the bad guys. So for what it's worth, the idea of not exposing my credit card is clearly there's a value proposition here that has it making sense. So
yay. Thank you.
Yeah, I have no problem. And as for SpinRite, he says, now to SpinRite. I have the rather unfortunate distinction of being the go-to guy in the family whenever there's computer trouble. You and Leo, you and I both know about that. He said, although I don't think it's unfortunate, I love helping people, but I think he does too. He says, I love helping them, but figuring out obscure problems can be quite the headache. My sister brought me her computer, which wouldn't boot into Windows. It wouldn't even see the boot record. I had fortuitously, he wrote, just bought SpinRite. Thank you very much, Bree, and decided to give it a go. As with many such stories, while no errors were reported, all of a sudden, the computer booted properly, saving me the headache of either formatting or buying a new hard drive and reinstalling Windows and all of my sister's applications, etc. Thank you very much for making this very useful tool. I look forward to the new versions when you get to it, and Squirrel when it becomes available. And on that note, I should mention two things. I meant to note that as for Twitter and their problem with storing their users' passwords in the clear or having logged them by mistake, that's something that Squirrel completely eliminates. As I've mentioned before, the Squirrel system gives websites no secrets to keep. That is, what websites store is the user's public key per site. So their per site public key. It's, first of all, not valuable to anyone else or useful to any other site. And having their public key is not a secret. I mean, like, their public key is not a secret. It's used to verify a challenge that they're able to sign a random challenge, and it's used as their identity, which is kind of cool because it's double function, but there's nothing to lose. The second thing I want to mention is it's done.
Woo-hoo!
I am Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Words I never thought I'd hear.
I know. I have begun building up the forums, the Squirrel forum server.
Yeah.
It's up and running. I've got PHP and MySQL and Zenforo as the forums system all up and running. I'm in the process of configuring it and customizing it and getting it set up. That's the last thing I need to do because I need somewhere a public web place to host all of the various aspects of Squirrel at people for people to ask questions and get answers. It's not something that I can ask either me or Sue or Greg to do. Everybody wants me back on SpinRite, which is what I intend to do as soon as I get this thing up and running. But it is ready. It is finished. Nice. And working on getting it public. Then I'm going to come up and spend some time with you and Father Robert, Leo, to do a Twitch special and tell the world about it.
Fantastic.
So it'll be really fun. Yes. And lastly, Spectre Next Gen. I guess it shouldn't be a surprise, and it's really kind of not, because as I said, I was surprised that Intel was even able to fix this kind of problem in the microcode. And as we know, they were not able to fix it on all of their architectures. Their earlier architectures didn't have the flexibility necessary in microcode to essentially add unplanned for instructions to give operating systems the control needed over branch prediction in order to mitigate the vulnerability. But the greater problem is that ever since we began trying to squeeze more processing power out of our chips, we've been willingly ignoring the fact that to do that, processors have been storing the history of code execution in sort of doing a mini version of on the fly compilation. That is, you know, if you're watching branches that are taken and not, and remembering whether that they're taken or not, and then using them to speculatively execute the branch you expect to be taken next time, then you're storing state based on what the code has done. And if you then switch the context back to a different process, it can cleverly figure out how the processor's behavior has been modified by the code that was previously running. That represents a cross-process boundary information leakage, and that's Spectre. So what has come to light? The site heise.de, heise.de, had the first coverage of this. There are 8 new CVE numbers that have been allocated bug identifiers, but their contents are currently being kept secret. Google's Project Zero has discovered 1 of 8 new Spectre flaws. This is, they're being called Spectre NG for next gen. Intel has internally classified, and this is all still, there's a complete cone of silence lid on this, nothing being said yet publicly. Heise got on the inside and had some dialogues, and under agreement of complete secrecy is as like, there's no specifics yet, but they have verified with second and third parties that all of their coverage of this. Intel has internally classified 4 of the 8 new Spectre NG vulnerabilities as high risk. The remaining 4 are rated as medium. According to Heise's research, the risks and attack scenarios for the Spectre NG flaws are similar to those for Spectre, with one important exception. One of the Spectre NG flaws simplifies attacks across system boundaries to such an extent, and I can't wait to learn what this is, because now I'm really curious. I mean, they, you know, as we know, there was some early meltdown proof of concept, because it was easy to do, but it was also easy to mitigate. That was the caching attack, an attack against caching that was easier to fix. There were never really any Spectre proof of concepts. There was just the Spectre of Spectre. This looks like something easy. They said it simplifies attacks across system boundaries to such an extent that the threat estimate is significantly higher than it ever was with Spectre. Specifically, an attacker could launch exploit code in a virtual machine and attack the host system from there, the server of a cloud host, for example. Alternatively, it could attack the VMs for other customers running on the same server. And Intel's software guard extensions, which are designed to protect sensitive data on cloud servers, are not Spectre safe. Heist believes that Intel is planning two rounds of patches. The first is scheduled to start in May. Apparently, this Project Zero timed out yesterday. So maybe Google is going to punt on their rigid 90-day deadline just because of how bad this is. I don't know that the one they discovered is this one of the eight that is really the most worrisome. Nothing happened yesterday, so maybe Intel has said, you know, we need a little more time on this. We just don't know. And of course, we also know that these microcode patches can be problematical themselves. So I'm sure we'll be talking about this in the weeks to come. Anyway, the first round is scheduled in May, and the second currently planned for August, which, you know, that wait, June, July, August, another 90 days downstream. So, and remember also that Spectre was 60 days embargoed, not the normal 90. I mean, these are really, you know, as we know, this was the big news at the beginning of this year, and now it's back for more. ARM systems are also believed to be affected by at least some of these eight new vulnerabilities, and we don't know about AMD. So stay tuned. But we do now have another worry. Now, again, understand that this is cross-process and cross-VM information leakage. So it's a concern for hosting providers, much less concern for individuals. You would have to have malware in your machine that was then, you know, stealing your credentials or stealing passwords and things. I mean, that's not good, but it's anomalous for you to have malware in your machine. It's not anomalous in a hosting provider because they're, you know, a hosting provider is saying, here's a virtual system, run anything you want. Well, bad guys could be running something trying to break out of the VM, get to the host or to get to another VM, which is legitimately running, you know, sharing that server's hardware. So end users, not such a problem, that never has been, probably still won't be. You know, you don't want malware in your machine at all. So this does break process boundary. And so in time, it's worth fixing it. But I would argue, given the problems we've seen with, you know, rushed out microcode patches, that it may be worth, you know, sitting back a little bit and not getting all hot and bothered over this until there's some reason to worry. So I'm sure we will have more information next week and in weeks to come on essentially a serious collapse in the fundamental security of the architecture of our processors as a consequence of how much was done to make them go fast.
Wow.
Yeah.
What's your sense? I mean, the next generation Intel processor is probably not going to fix this. It's going to be a year.
Yes, the problem is that the processor development pipeline is years deep. Right. I mean, it's, you know, the stuff they're working on now that they will definitely resolve this for won't come out the other end until 2020, you know, at the earliest. So maybe they can fudge some improvements into what they've already got in the pipeline. But they've got an install base they need to worry about. They've got their already in the pipeline yet not released. I mean, it's a little difficult to buy a new Intel chip that has known bugs in it.
Yeah.
So, you know, yeah, ouch. It's a mess.
But it's not like you could go use somebody else's processor. We kind of have to live with it.
We don't know about AMD. It'll be interesting to see. That, you know, that could hurt Intel if their AMD processors are vulnerable. Problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
But I wonder how likely that is, given that they have the other Spectre meltdown flaws.
Yes, and the fact that ARM systems are also vulnerable. So this sounds like another new type of bad problem. I can't wait to find out what this is more exploitable.
Exploits in the wild?
No.
One thing I worry a little bit about is that we're starting – we talk about all exploits as if they're the same.
Right.
But really, they're not. And I think that exploit hunters are incentivized for a variety of reasons to publish these. But they may be very, very hard to implement.
Yes. And in fact, it's easy to make the point that when people – updated their systems with that first round of Intel patches and they started crashing and blue screening and having all kinds of problems, that was the fix was much more of an actual problem than what it was trying to cure.
We need to start now. They've always had severity ratings, but everybody says everything's severe at this point, so exploitability ratings or real threat ratings or, you know, I mean, because severity really doesn't reflect the real threat. It reflects merely how far in somebody who uses the exploit could get, how bad it would be if somebody used the exploit. What it doesn't address is how...
We need the GAS rating, Leo.
What's that?
GAS. Give a shish.
That's exactly what we need. That really is, and I don't think we have good information about whether this is one to freak out about, or that's one to freak out about. I mean, we know ransomware, we know Petya was something to freak out about, and still is, legitimately so.
Yep.
But we've not seen any of these exploited in the wild, despite the fact that most computers are still not patched and may never be patched.
So it's, should I gas or not?
Should I gas?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, the best way to keep track of all this, of course, keep listening to Security Now. We do it every normally Wednesday. We're on our regular time. What am I saying? Everything else got moved. You were the floating island that everything else moved around.
A little jet lag, my friend, but other than that, we're right.
Well, no, I've thought you were on Wednesday ever since you were on Wednesday.
That's
right. It is Tuesday and has been for years, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. If you want to watch live, you can go to twit.tv/live. We are a little later than usual, that's for sure. You can also get copies of the show from Steve's site, grc.com. He has the 64 kilobit audio and transcriptions. And I know that's hugely valuable to a lot of you. Not the least because you can search for it and search for information from the shows because the transcripts are searchable. Isn't that nice? We have audio and video at our website, twit.tv/SN. And you can always subscribe whatever you podcast app you use. I promise you we don't collect information about you. We do collect your IP address. Somebody does. Maybe we don't do that. I think we do. Cashfly does, the company that does the downloads. And I don't, I just don't know.
Well, and Leo, let's remember, anything your browser touches is an IP address.
It's saying
your
hello.
IP is just being sprayed all over the globe.
Well, and I looked, and there is some debate about whether the EU will consider IP addresses personal information. And if you were to err on the side of caution, you would say that it is. In which case, I don't know what we're going to do. We may have to block this show to all people who live in the EU. I think I found a JavaScript snippet I can use. No, actually, that site's down. I think that they got forced off the
thing. Wow. Yeah. Interesting.
Steve Gibson, have a great week, and we will see you next time.
My friend. Righto. Bye.
Security Now.